Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Gentlemen, if you like the strange or paranormal, you've come to the right place. But don't say I didn't warn you.
Hello, thanks for joining us today. Just a little preamble before we get to the interview. If you're willing and able, please leave a review on iTunes, Stitcher, etc. It really does help us, and most grateful. And obviously I will be mentioning those people who do next week, beginning of next week's show. Now my next guest is Brian Forrester. You can check him out on thehiddeninkatours.com if you like what he says today. And if you're like me, if you hate the fact that science is the be-all and end-all of everything, and what it says goes, even, you know, and they get these things where it just doesn't add up, but they just turn a blind eye to it, or they just ignore it, like Göbekli Tepe and places like that, you know what I mean? All this stuff that's in plain sight, and they just won't accept it. Well, if you're like me and you find it a bit strange, and I'm still 0% sure as to why the cover-up, yeah, assuming there is one. Well, it's a really interesting interview, actually. I find it mind-blowing. But if you like it, then please pass on your feedback to us, and obviously we can forward it to Brian and then hopefully have him back on the show again, because we do want to have him back on. And you can reach us at dbtopodcast@gmail.com. Said too much now, so let's just get on with the show. What was your aha moment, if you like? I don't know if you use that phrase in America. You know, like your eureka moment, where you realised you was looking at potentially the evidence of a lost civilization.
It was actually my first trip to Cusco. I hired a local tour guide, and he took me to many different locations, and he said, yeah, the Inca built this, the Inca built that, and I noticed a glaring difference in style. Some of the stuff was like stone with mortar construction and adobe brick and that kind of thing. And I thought, yeah, that the Inca could have done that. But then some of the megalithic work where you can't fit a human hair in the joints, I've worked with power tools all my life, and I thought, how the hell would we do that?
Yeah,
definitely.
I know. I've actually seen some photographs, which I think are your photographs of this. And I like the one where you show, there's like a, you know, it looks like someone later on's come along and tried to rebuild one of the walls. And
yeah, I watched that. It's fascinating.
They've dropped a stone in, but it's, on the face, it looks all right. But as over the years, the walls crumble down or whatever, you can actually see inside the wall, and you can see where this rock or this that they've placed in doesn't quite fit inside, you know what I mean? So you can see that obviously someone's tried to emulate what they're seeing, but they're not quite got the skills to do it. And when we come on to, you know, building these walls, what tools were these people meant to be using? Regarding mainstream science version of it.
Well, they honestly believed that the Inca did all of this with bronze chisels. And they're adamant about that. Bronze is a very soft metal, mm-hmm. and the stone that's being worked on is basalt and granite, which are like twice the hardness.
Mm. Did the people who came later on, did they use the same materials as well?
Well, the more you look, the more you can see that the city of Cusco and a lot of the other ancient sites like Machu Picchu were destroyed by some kind of cataclysmic event.
Yeah.
So then thousands of years later, when the Incas show up, they don't do anything with the what's still intact, but then they use the material that's fallen down to rebuild. And then when they run out of that material, then they use local material, a different kind of stone. Yeah. And that's where it starts to become really glaringly obvious that you have two very different types of technology involved.
Mm. I mean, you're almost looking at a difference between modern day brick and, mud and clay. It's that obvious what you're looking at. It's different colours. It's just so obvious. I'll get into the mainstream science view on it all towards the end, because obviously there's, something not right with what they're saying.
But yeah.
As for a lost civilization of people, and I'm going to come on to the Prakas people shortly, but as for this lost civilization, it's my belief that we're looking at potentially, not just in Peru and places like that, but like Göbekli Tepe, Baalbek, Easter Island. We're looking at in some places in Europe as well, I'd go along as far as to say that. We're looking at potentially a lost civilization that we don't know too much about. Is that
or what's been hidden?
What's not
going to be talked about in mainstream schools or colleges?
Is that something what you believe to be possible or true?
I think definitely, because we're looking at... we're looking at levels of technology at least as good as what we have, or in some cases even more sophisticated and mysterious, depending upon where you look. I think there were at least three different advanced civilizations, because their building techniques are completely different.
Yeah, and it's counterintuitive almost. So you've got like the best building at the beginning. You know what I mean? And then the more modern you get, the worse the building seems to get. I mean, you'd think it would be the other way around.
Exactly. And it's at all of these locations. If you look at Baalbek, or you look at sites in Egypt or Peru, Bolivia, Easter Island, even India and other locations, you see very sophisticated work to start with. And then it actually does get worse as time goes on.
Mm. Just gets a bit shoddy and a bit rushed. You know what I mean? It's almost a bit... It looks a bit lazily done towards, the further as you get on. Some of it's still beautiful and, well, obviously craftsmen did a lot of it, but it just seems that little bit... they either had less time to do it or...
Not the tools.
Not the skills, what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's clear and obvious the more you look at it. Moving on to the Paracas people then. It's only a few years ago where I stumbled across the Paracas people, and I don't know. I think a lot of it we still don't really understand about the Paracas people. But do you think these people? And I know like some of the skulls have been only dated to be as old as possibly only 2,000 years old. But is there a possibility that they could extend further back into history than that?
Yeah, it could. The problem is that there aren't any academics really studying that culture, which I find very strange. The last major research was done in the 1960s, and so that was before there was such things as really good radiocarbon testing, and definitely DNA testing didn't exist then. So that's why I took it up, because I'm actually living in the Paracas area, and I have access to all these ancient sites and ancient skulls and things like that. And so I've taken it on myself to try to figure out who these people were.
Have you come to any cast iron conclusions as to where they originate from?
Not yet. One of the local major archaeologists, I sat down with him and I asked him two simple questions. I said, do you know why they seem to have had genetically red hair, which is not something Native Americans have? And he said, no. And then I said, do you know for sure where they came from? Because they seem to just spontaneously appear. And he said, no. Mm. So that's when I suggested, well, how about if you get permission for us to take DNA or bone samples so we can do DNA testing? And he started that process 25 months ago, and we're almost at the point where we can achieve that.
Oh, great. That sounds interesting. So, my belief in this lost civilization theory, if you like, and the Paracas people being part of that, I almost think we're looking at, I'd almost go say definitely looking at a seafaring race, because of the amount of places where these people pop up. Just for the people that don't know about the Prakas people, can you explain the differences between the Prakas people and, you know, what we class ourselves as the Homo sapien generic archetype, if you like?
Sure. Well, the most glaring difference is, well, that the even standard archaeology states that the Prakas appeared as a people about 800 BC and then disappeared about 100 AD. And they believe that it was just local nomadic people who collectively got together and became a specific type of person, if you want. But the glaring differences are that now we know they had genetically red hair. And if you have genetic red hair, it means you have very light skin color.
Yeah.
So those are two characteristics which are not Native American. And also, they seem to be averaging about 6 feet tall, which is at least half a foot taller than most of the native people of Peru. Mm-hmm. They lived underground in these underground houses. And I think the reason for that is because they had light colored skin.
Yeah, that's out the sun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Paracas is sunny 365 days a year. So if you had light skin, you couldn't really survive happily if you were spending too much time outside. So that suggests that they must have come from somewhere else.
Yeah.
And so when you look at the genetics of red hair, it originates in the Middle East. And
really?
And then when you – yeah, no, yeah, it's not a Celt.
My principal thing would have been Celts or Scandinavia, but that's interesting, Middle East.
Yeah, well the origins of those people are likely originally Middle Eastern.
Oh, yeah.
At least one wave of migration. And then, when you know, like you were saying, in terms of migration, if you start to say, okay, if they came from the Middle East, maybe, then let's follow the path. The shortest path would be across the Pacific and then into the Indian Ocean. And the first stop along the way is Easter Island. And on Easter Island, they have stories of a pre-Polynesian people who were red-haired and very light-skinned. So that could be the connection between the Paracas and the coast of Peru. And they also say that the first Easter Island people also had elongated skulls.
Really?
So that's what we're tracking now.
Yeah. And, I mean, Easter Island itself is fascinating. I mean, it was only recently that they discovered that these statues and everyone will know what these...
Bodies.
Yeah, they have bodies as well as absolutely. Just the head sticking up. So that would allude to them being there a lot longer than... I mean, unless it was purposely buried... I mean, but if, you know, if it's just a case of soil and all the rest of it, you know, amounting over time, they've been there a long while.
Mm.
Yeah, I was actually there with Dr. Robert Schock, who's a geologist, and he's an expert on weathering of stone. And he looked around. We noticed that there are two different kinds of Moai. There's one older style, and then there's a later Polynesian style.
Yeah. So again, we're seeing two different building types, distinctively different, you know, in popping up all over the place.
Yeah.
So obviously Easter Island being an island, and you know, and like I was talking about this lost civilization, in my belief, being a seafaring race, do we find any evidence that the Prakas people could sail, or? I know boats don't generally...
Not really.
You don't generally find them unless they're buried, you know, like the Viking boats and stuff. But do we find any evidence, you know, in their tapestries or anything like that they could sail?
Yeah, actually, there is quite a bit of evidence. The local reed that grows here is called Totora, which Thor Heyerdahl used in order to build... I think it was either Ra or Tigris that he made. So you can build a reed boat 100 or 150 feet long, if you want. And also, cotton is indigenous to this area. So there's your sail-making material. Mm. Also, we find in the artifacts from 2,000-plus years ago, things like spondylus shell, which is only found off the coast of Ecuador to the north. So it's unlikely that would have been traded by people walking up and down the coast, it's much more likely that that these people sailed north, and the predominant winds blow from the south towards Ecuador anyway. Mm. So that's some of the evidence we have.
So you'd think they just happened to land there and you know, made a settlement there. So they just pop up from nowhere, essentially. So I suppose, you know, moving on from that, because obviously they're not around anymore, so we'll have to touch on that.
Well, I don't think so.
But the elongated skull aspect of the Prakas people, is this just, you know, the royals of that culture, or is this just, you know, a trait of the Prakas people themselves?
It's only a trait of the nobility, the chiefly class and the priestly class, and that's it.
Okay, so would that be genetic then, or is it this cradle board, and or?
It depends on the time frame. It seems that the early, like about 4 to 5% of them, are larger in volume than a normal human being, and the shape is so complicated that would not be cradle headboarding. The later generations appear to have bred with normal-looking people, and so that would have started to dilute the genetic characteristics of having a naturally elongated skull. So when you go back to the origin ones, they are very different than any form of cranial deformation.
Mm. And just the fact that they would have had light skin and red hair, you know, stands them out. You know, in South America, you know, obviously, but so it's not just the elongated skull, though. I mean, looking at the skulls, and I'm presuming you've actually got hands on with these skulls, have you?
Oh, hundreds of them.
Yeah. So you will know the difference. Is it possible that they have slightly different cheekbones? And I noticed that they seem to have bigger eyes. Is that something that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the eye sockets are much larger, I would say 50% larger than normal.
50%?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the cheekbones, they look a bit raised.
Yeah, and actually an artist in Florida, Marcia Moore, has done three-dimensional computer reconstruction of many of them. And they don't really look like the typical Native Americans of the area. They look like a mix of having Caucasian and Native features.
Yeah, I think I've seen those, actually. But did she give them, like, a more browner skin than they probably had?
Yeah, she's given them kind of a neutral... Yeah, I would say more of a... at least a light brown color. But yeah. It's an ongoing thing. Every time I find a new interesting skull, I send her photographs, and then she rebuilds that. It's a learning process for all of us.
Absolutely. And like you say, there's not many people looking into this. That's part of the problem. So when we get onto these skulls, then, you know, obviously the glaring differences between Homo sapiens skull and the priestly class, if you will, or the royal class of the Prakas, is this coronal and sagittal suture. Is that the right
mm-hmm.
word?
Yeah.
And the fact that this sagittal suture's missing, I don't know if it's possible. I mean, the idea of these things, as far as my understanding goes, is that when an infant's born or a baby's born, the head actually squashes to allow passage through the pelvis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, you know, so the obviously needed. Yeah. So would it even be possible for a woman? I don't know if there's any cases in the world where this has actually happened, where a baby's been born without these and it's just some genetic problem or whatever, but. Is it possible for even a woman to have a child without this hole in the head, essentially?
I think the pelvic structure would have to be different, and that's something that we're trying to pursue. It's difficult to find an intact skeleton, and then, of course, you require medical personnel to do the analysis, but that's another thing that we're definitely looking at doing.
Just looking at the actual pelvis size of the Prakas people compared to Homo sapiens.
That would
obviously lend weight to this theory that they were actually of a different genome potentially. And I'm not going down the alien route here. But obviously, like, you can't rule out anything, I suppose. But they're obviously not Homo sapien as we know. I think that's fair to say. So
Yeah.
So this emulation of this elongated skull, which we find all over the world, and you know, I've seen cases. I've just been looking, you know, last few days, just on cases of this. And obviously, Egypt comes up, Congo, Malta, Olmec people, and I think I heard you mention that even places in Europe, which I was unaware of, this elongated skull has been emulated, and now we are talking about people doing it with bands and rocks and that. Is there any more places that I've missed off?
Actually, basically, cranial deformation was performed on average about 2,000 years ago, and it existed in cultures on every one of the continents except Antarctica. In your part of the world, the most interesting recent discoveries have been found by Maria Wheatley, who was able to get access to elongated skulls that were found at Stonehenge.
Really?
And it's a strange place where your barrows come in, you know, with the barrows in Wiltshire. And,
actually, that's exactly it, because she found that all these skulls are being hidden on an army base somewhere in Salisbury Plain. But what she's been able to find out is that the long barrows were for people with elongated heads, and round barrows were for normal people.
Yeah, and this is probably why we don't have access to these barrows.
There was a few we can go into. I've been into these barrows, some of them, and they're quite neat.
But all the bodies have been removed.
Is cut off, you're not allowed to go anywhere near.
So when we see, because I'll have to speak to her. Is she doing, where can we find her work, just out of interest?
She lives in Avebury.
Yeah,
and she's very easy to find on the internet. She has a website, and she's on Facebook. She conducts tours in the Avebury area and other parts of Britain as well.
Yeah, Avebury's beautiful. Been a fantastic place.
Look into that. So this cradle boarding and this deformation then. Obviously, it's still going on. I presume it's still going on today, and cultures around the world probably. It's probably just kept, you know, under wraps. But do we have any insight as to why they are doing it? Do they have a reason for why they're doing it?
Well, the basic consensus, whether you're talking about the Congo or Melanesia or amongst the Maya or Attila the Hun, you know, it goes on and on, is it was a way to distinguish the nobility from the commoners. It was also thought to increase the level of intelligence. They thought it was a beautiful looking shape, and generally they say we are emulating our ancestors.
Yeah, so it definitely is emulation in that. So they are trying to look like something that went before. So that's fair to say then. So
right.
As for volume, obviously changing the shape of the skull, we're not increasing the brain size here, or is the brain size the same?
I've asked a lot of doctors about that, and they said that you can reshape the skull when a baby's newborn because it's such soft material, but you can't change the genetics of volume. So if you change the shape, the plates are going to find each other through the suture, and no matter how much you try to manipulate them, you can't make the volume increase.
Okay, so it's just pure. But is there any health problems? Obviously, there's still people, I presume, in like African tribes and Polynesian, like you said, do this today. Do we find that there's any health problems to people that have had this done, or did they just live normal lives? Or
actually, in antiquity, we find a lot of trepanation going on amongst the Paracas and Inca cultures. A lot of the elongated skulls have drill holes in them.
Yeah, I've got a theory on that actually. So obviously that would lend weight to there being problems, you'd think, like pressure in the head or something going on. So do we not get that with people that still do it? I mean, even up till recently, people in the Congo and that were doing this, I think. So do we not have stories of them having the same issues?
Well, as far as I know, in Melanesia and also the Congo, missionaries and governments stopped the practice, probably at least 20 years ago. But the more interesting point is that the Paracas 2000.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah. Right, we lost you there. Yeah, I was just talking about the more interesting point was
that the Paracas were doing successful brain surgery 2000 years ago.
Mm. See, I've got a different theory on that than brain surgery, and it is total speculation on my part because I don't know anything about brains, but my theory, and I don't know if you believe in ghosts or anything like that, but my theory on ghosts and there's a lot of evidence that children, see spirits more readily than everybody else, and it seems that when they grow older, they lose the ability. And I wonder if this hole in the head was almost a way of opening up that hole that, you know, we have naturally when we're born, to access this spirit realm or...
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I think you're implying the pineal gland.
The pineal gland being pineal part gland. Of that, yeah, a big part of that. And that's one of my theories, you know, based on children seeing ghosts. And I don't know if there's any... Hello?
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 We got you back.
Got you back.
That's the Skype being a bitch, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, so what I was saying is, so that's my theory on, and it's like I say, it's far-fetched, obviously, but, the evidence seems to point that way, with children seeing ghosts, I mean. So, if that was the case in the Paracas people, and I'm not talking about the actual Paracas people, I'm talking about the people who genetically, the people that they're mated with, potentially, needing access to this particular realm. Because you hear about all these stories about them moving, because some of these blocks that they moved around were massive, and you hear about vibration and all this kind of, super technology that we don't even have access to today, potentially.
Well, these beings, I believe, they could manipulate energy, manipulate, stone.
Well, it seems to be, muted about. So... with this access to the spirit world or whatever you want to call it, is that something that we know very little about the Paracas people in the actual spiritual world?
Well, again, the problem is that they died out about 2,000 years ago. They did leave behind a lot of textiles and pottery and things, and there are many depictions of people flying, so that could be probably astral travel. Mm. It's actually one of the most common aspects of the Paracas are people flying.
Yeah, flying. I mean, you get that with hallucination as well. And again, that's linked to this pineal gland. Is my theory where my theory goes. It could just be the astral projection from dreams, I guess. So, you've kind of opened an interesting can of worms there for me. But,
Yeah. Well, actually, there is a local hallucinogen here from the San Pedro cactus that it's likely that the priestly class of the Paracas used to do visionary work.
Yeah.
So is this the same stuff as like ayahuasca?
It's actually ayahuasca is from the jungle.
Yeah.
So they achieve to some degree the same purpose, but they are completely different plants. The San Pedro only grows in the real desert part of Peru, which is where I am.
Mm. So, and again, this it pops up on Ancient Aliens all the time. So these Nazca lines and them flying over them. I know the Paracas people were said to have made some of the lines there as well. So, would this be for that reason, or do you think it was more of a signpost type situation?
I actually wrote a book on Nazca because it's actually very close to where I am, and the system begins about 10 miles from where I am. There's this giant geoglyph called the Candelabra, which is 500 feet tall, and it's on the side of a mountain. You can only see it from the ocean, and then when you travel from there through to Nazca, which is about 200 kilometers, there are numerous other geoglyphs and lines all the way through. People only talk about Nazca, but the Nazca contains about 25 figures, you know, huge figures that the Nazca people made. But between the town of Paracas itself and Nazca, there are more than 1,000 smaller ones that the Paracas culture created.
Mm. And that one that you talked about there, which can only be seen from the sea, I mean, that obviously lends weight to them being a seafaring race of some, you know, using that as a signpost of some description, you'd say, wouldn't you?
Oh, definitely. And actually, the great theory by my mentor, Senior Juan Navarro, was that it represents the Southern Cross, because the Southern Cross rises right behind it, and Southern Cross has been used as a navigational marker for thousands of years.
Yeah, by sailors, absolutely, yeah. Because you know, that's one of the, you know, people always try and say, well, no, they couldn't travel these vast different distances because they didn't have, you know, a compass, they didn't have this and that. But using the stars, people for a long time know how to travel the world. I think it's, we try and think that we're so intelligent, you know, but
which we're not.
It's just blows your mind, really.
Yeah.
So how far back is it? Would you say these Paracas people go? And obviously you've talked about them origins possibly being Middle Eastern, and I know, like, you know, I've already mentioned Lebanon and Göbekli Tepe, and again in Lebanon you get these massive stones, you know, obviously Romans built later on upon them, but we don't generally see Romans moving 1,000-ton stones. There's no need, is there, for them to do it? They can do it. They've got enough manpower to do, you know, as many little blocks as they want. So,
I mean, this was portrayed in Egypt, wasn't it? All the slaves, yeah, building the pyramids, well, which, yeah, I find quite impossible.
That's another one.
Quite,
yeah,
impossible.
So, would you say these buildings that are being built over the Middle East, of these grand buildings, would this possibly be related to the same people?
It could be. It's kind of too early to know, but in terms of a Baalbek, it's the most glaringly obvious example of there being two cultures. And we had a local tour guide who said, you know, the Romans built this and they moved this 1,200, you know, or these 1,200 ton stones from the quarry over here. And it's like, well, how did they move them? And well, I don't know. And also, why did they use 1,200 ton blocks? And her explanation was they wanted to impress the local people. So that just, you know, that's it's quite stupid. So when you actually go to Baalbek, then you can see obviously that somebody was constructing something on a huge scale, and then probably abandoned the project, maybe as a result of a cataclysmic earthquake. And then thousands of years later, the Romans show up and they decide to use what's there as the foundation, and then simply picked up all the other bits that were lying around and stacked them on top and, you know, created their temple of Jupiter and stuff, yeah, like that. Yeah.
So, I mean, even that explanation there where they're saying, oh, they did it to impress people. If you was going to impress people by doing this, you'd make them more prominent, obviously. You wouldn't build something on top of them, you'd think. You know, you'd have them standing up or, you know, like some sort of obelisk, or, do you know what I mean? You'd make a spectacle of them, wouldn't you?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, you have the Trilithon, which is three blocks in a row,
yeah,
of 1,000 tons each. And then everything else is smaller. Then you have a different wall there composed of about 10 800 ton blocks. And then a bunch of stuff is put on top of it. And then there's another wall of, I think, 600 ton blocks with a bunch of stuff put on top of it.
Yeah, it just doesn't add up. I mean, and I'm not a scientist, I'm not an archaeologist, I'm, you know, I'm just a Joe Bloggs, but I can look at this and think there's something not right here. So why do you think And I had this conversation with someone else the other day about science, and he was talking about this was in relation to ghosts and stuff like that, and science has already debunked it and all that. Well, actually, science doesn't even look at it, you know? So, and I think it's the same in this as well. Science has got an explanation for all this, but it's not even looking into it. So why do you think... And obviously your DNA testing will go a long way to answer some of these questions, but why do you think science is turning, and it is turning, a blind eye to all this? You know, what's the obsession with this this manufactured history, you know, status quo? What would you be your theories on that?
Well, because some of this stuff just doesn't fit in with their timeline. So, you know, so they're insisting, you know, to bring up Egypt, they're insisting that it was Khufu and Khafre and Menkaura who had the three great pyramids on the Giza Plateau built, you know, as tombs. But then when you bring an engineer to Giza and you say, and an architect, and you say, so with a Bronze Age technology culture such as the dynastic Egypt of 2,500 years ago, could they achieve this? And the answer is no, because the Great Pyramid itself, it's been calculated that if it was built in 25 years, which is what the standard story is, they would have had to have cut, moved, shaped, and put into place one multi-ton block of the 2.3 million of them every 2 minutes.
I mean,
it's impossible.
That is impossible. But
impossible.
Again, speculation. But if they had access to this technology, what the Prakas people seem to have used, then obviously that is possible. But you think that if they had access to this stuff, they would have mentioned it, you know, because it was pretty good at writing stuff down. So do we have any stories of, you know, taking the pyramids as an example, do we have any stories of the people, you know, that still live in Egypt now? Do they have any stories of these pyramids being there before the dynastic Egyptians got there? I mean, because we do hear stories like that in Peru and places like that, you know, and obviously the wider Mayan buildings, if you like. We hear stories that the people actually say these places were here before we got here. That's my understanding. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, the best people are the people I work with at the Kemet School. They live across the street from the Sphinx, and they have oral tradition that goes way far beyond the dynastic Egyptians. And it's clear to them that the dynastic Egyptians showed up about 3100 BC, and the three great pyramids were standing there in a state of decay. Also other pyramids at Dahshur, as well as the 100-ton granite boxes, which are found in tunnels underground at Saqqara, that all of that was there, and it was simply adopted. And then hieroglyphics were carved on flat, smooth surfaces.
Yeah, so they just took over these places. And those granite tubs, I've seen pictures of them. Are they the ones that they say that there's some sort of sacrificial bull was buried in, but there's no evidence of any bulls being buried under them? Is that the same ones?
That's exactly right. Yeah. Supposedly, you know, it was the first French, I think, archaeologist who stumbled across. They had to dig down to find it, and they found these two tunnels with, I think, 2,700-ton boxes inside. With the lids were ajar, but there was no evidence of any bull of any kind found in there. But he decided that that's what they were for, and you know, the story just continues and continues.
And what was the dimensions of them? Do you know offhand?
Oh gee, at a guess they're about I think they're 8 feet tall. 12 feet wide and about at least 15 to 20 feet long.
I would say so, yeah. And that's my impression of looking at them. So, I mean, that's obviously bigger than most bulls anyway, so why you jump to a bull conclusion is beyond me. But again, it's like science always has to come up with an answer rather than just saying we don't know. Which should be the default position, and until you've done the testing and all the rest, or until you found some evidence, you'd think the default position would be, we don't know. It's a mystery. But we seem to have these answers that are just given, and that goes into becoming gospel then. You know, because like I was just saying about that particular thing, I've seen those and I've seen them being called bull sarcophaguses. So, you know,
most people will just accept that. You know, that
this
is what they say is true.
Definitely, yeah. Part of the problem. It becomes status quo then, and then that's just. And again, oral tradition for me is key to a lot of this, because we get the Aboriginal people have an oral tradition and they can tell you everything that's happened in their history, and when you actually look at it, it's spot on. And I think we find that with a lot of Native American cultures as well. So obviously I'm presuming that's the same with the South American cultures.
Yeah, that's right. Well, for example, we know that, that Cusco was older than the Inca. The standard story of academia is that the Inca found virgin land and built the city. But when the first Spanish arrived and they saw the huge wall of Sacsayhuaman for the first time, which contains stones of 125 tons, they asked the local people, did you or your ancestors construct this? And they said, no, this was here when we got here.
Yeah, and I think we have reports of Cortez when he first met the people there. I think they told him that there was the giants, what they refer to as giants, and we're not talking about 20-foot tall people here, we're talking about people that were slightly bigger than those. But they actually refer to giants being there when they came. And I think there's letters from Cortez, actually. I think it was actually Cortez's general, but talking about that. So, you know, that's accepted in history. But again, it'll be classed as a story that the Aztec people told them, I guess. But with this Paracas people being found, it sort of lends weight to, you know, they was probably telling the truth. I mean, they've got no reason to. You'd think they've got no reason to lie, really. I mean, if you had a massive, you know, beautiful structure like that, and someone came along and said, "Did you build that?" Why wouldn't you say yes?
I think it's, well, what we know about the Inca is that they were a very honorable, truthful people, and that's the major problem they had with the Spanish. Well, the Spanish were very cunning and very good at lying about their intents and what they planned to do there. So, unfortunately, that was part of the major downfall of the Inca, was that they took the Spanish to their word.
Yeah. And they just coerced them, and the rest is history, I suppose. So, getting to the Paracas people then, from what I've seen about the Paracas people, and again, what little we know, they seem to have a great understanding of agriculture and irrigation. Would that be true?
Oh, yeah, on a phenomenal level, because this area only gets half an inch of rainfall a year. So they were able to access underground streams and use those to divert those for agriculture, which was very ingenious. That's part of the logic behind the Nazca line system, is that some of them are mapping underground rivers and stream systems.
Yeah, which absolutely would make sense, rather than runways or whatever space. But to build. And again, this goes back to megalithic structures and all the rest of it. To build or spend time, because obviously it takes a long while to build these structures, then to build these things, you need to have some sort of agricultural base, you know, to support people. So, again, this lends weight to these, you know, and, you know, I can even talk about Stonehenge or any of these places, having some sort of more understanding of agriculture and all the rest of it than, and particularly I'm talking about Göbekli Tepe here as well. They must have had, they couldn't be built by hunter-gatherers, I wouldn't say. Would you go along with that?
Yeah, you definitely have to have a sophisticated, centralized society to be able to coordinate the construction of anything like that.
And this is in a time where we're told, mainstream science tells us that these people didn't have any ability to have writing or, you know, access to anything, to write anything down or, you know. So it looks like it was built by a civilization that had more technology than the people that are said to have built it. You know, I think that's...
So are we talking off-world here? We're talking.
I don't think we need to talk about aliens. I think it looks like these people were here and then they died out. Do we have any understanding of how these Prakas people died out?
Yeah, actually, the theory that I'm developing is that there was a climate change that occurred about 2,000 years ago. And again, this area is very desert-like. So what happened was there was a group of people living slightly to the north called the Topara, and they lived in worse rain conditions than even the Paragas. So I think they had to abandon their land and move south, and they moved into the fertile area of the Paracas and probably took over by wiping out the royal family with the elongated skulls, because this new people actually became what we call the Nazca. And so in the archaeological record, red hair and elongated skulls disappear with the rise of the Nazca people. The Nazca people did not have red hair or elongated skulls, but the Paracas did. So that leads me to a theory about genocide.
Absolutely. So you think that the agriculture and the irrigation could have been their downfall then?
Well, their success in being able to grow food in such an austere environment led others to want to take over.
Yeah. Yeah. So, we don't just find, we find that in, you know, the Fertile Crescent in Egypt and places like that as well. It's a similar story, and obviously Mesopotamia. So, you know, that understanding, obviously, because if people haven't got the, you know, that ability to grow food and particularly, you know, hydrate themselves, then obviously they're going to look to the next people. And if you outnumber those people, you know, because there weren't that many Prakas people, were there? Now, I did a story about a Peru, somewhere in Peru, there was meant to be something called a skull room. It says. I had 10,000 skulls allegedly in there. Is that even possible?
It is. Actually, it's been confirmed by archaeologists I know. It's a big room that has 10,000 Peruvian skulls. I saw a 15-second video that somebody shot inside there, because it's completely off limits. But there were numerous very elongated skulls in there. So they probably have... I would guess they have 500 to 1,000 Paracas skulls.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot. Would this just be skulls or complete skeletons?
And full mummies as well.
Yeah. Well, mummies, see, again, you know, when you've got mummies, you've got a DNA treasure trove, haven't you, really?
But oh,
especially,
yeah.
You know, because I got a lot of these skulls, again, the found were hair on and that, which is, you know, testament to their ability to mummify. And again, that's something we see in various cultures, this mummification of the bodies. Obviously, Egypt being the, you know, the case in point in that one. Do you think, and I think Malta as well, I don't know but off the top of my head, but these places, again, is this emulation, do you think, or is this something that springs up naturally in human culture?
I'm not, that's a great question. It's just the fact that the environment here is so dry that it naturally preserves anything. We don't know why the Paracas royalty were buried in such a obviously they were adored, so they were buried in cavernous chambers in some cases as much as 20 feet underground. And they were buried with their favorite bowls and other ceremonial objects. But as to whether that means that they were to reincarnate or whether those artifacts were only to be used by them, we don't know.
And you know, I heard that they was buried facing the sea. Is that right?
I'll have to look. I'll ask my archaeologist friend that. That's a great question. The royal cemeteries tend to look out over agriculture and then the ocean beyond.
Yeah.
So it is quite possible that, you know, that the heads were facing west, maybe towards the homeland.
Yeah, that's what's going to be my question. I mean, obviously, when you're talking about a peninsula or an island, I suppose you're always going to be looking to the sea, aren't you? But to some extent. But if they're all aligned in a, you know, they are all aligned in a specific way, then obviously, again, you know, my understand or my belief is that we are talking about some sort of lost civilization that was a seafaring race. So again, if they're looking to the sea, again, like you said, to the homeland, maybe. Yeah. So that's as much as what I've got on the Prakas people, I suppose. Is there anything that I'm, you know, that I really need to know about the Prakas people? What, you know, what should give me a greater understanding that you know about?
Well, they did have they were quite an early culture here. The Inca came about 1,000 years afterwards, so they had the most sophisticated textiles of any people in the Americas. Mm. They also seem to have known the potter's wheel, which is not known in Mesoamerica. And of course the red hair, etc. We have started to do DNA testing, and of the first four examples that were done, the only haplogroup or DNA that was able to be recovered turns out to be either Northern European or Middle Eastern.
Mm. Yeah, that again is fascinating. That's it just throws everything into confusion, doesn't it, then, at that point, what we've been told, and at least we've got some sort of proof, as it were, that we're not being told the history, or, you know, maybe not deliberate, but obviously we're getting to the bottom of what might have actually happened. So, and again, when you're talking about textiles, this, and the potter's wheel, for instance, this is a culture that must have been around a long time to have these technologies, you know. You know, they haven't just sprung up and died out. You know, if they've got these things, they've been around a while. And whether they brought them with them from somewhere else or... do you know what I mean? Again, that would show that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think that, again, that could be another Middle Eastern connection, because the finest textiles, as far as I know, that have ever been made and still are those of the Middle East. And also the potter's wheel was invented in the Middle East as well. So I think they were technologies that were brought with them when they I think they were forced to flee from some area by some marauding. You know, the Middle East has always been in conflict. So it's probably some marauding tribe decided to move in, and these people had no choice but to take to the sea.
Mm. Yeah, that would be my theory as well, and that seems to be, because we don't see, after a certain point in the Middle East, say 2,000 years ago or whatever, we don't seem to see these people there, so they obviously have to leave at some point and again take to the sea. That would be my belief on that. So
yeah,
moving on to the tours that you do, are these tours taking people off the beaten track, as it were?
Yeah, we go to the conventional sites like Machu Picchu and Sacsayhuaman and Pumapunku and places, but we also try to add in smaller, more obscure sites that are not known to the general public as well.
Mm. And I mean, do these places hold more of a glimpse of what science is trying to cover up?
I would say, yeah, there are examples of that. Most people who go to Tiwanaku, which is in the highlands of Bolivia, don't even bother going to Pumapunku, which is more interesting and it's right next door. But, you know, the general public, I don't think, have any great interest in in-depth study of anything. So if a tour guide says, well, we're going to Tiwanaku and we're not going to bother about that pile of stones over there on the left, then they'll go, oh, okay. But if they've done any research beforehand, they'd know that there's some stone-cutting technology involved at Pumapunku, which is at least 21st-century technology.
Yeah. And I've seen examples of that in Egypt. I mean, there's this, what they call Core 7, is it? And it's like a granite... it's a drill hole, basically, in granite. I don't know if you've seen it, and I think there's some examples of that in out your way as well. which we just don't understand how they were capable of doing that.
That's true.
Have you seen that firsthand?
Oh, yeah. The best site is called Abu Sir, which tourists basically don't go to. And there are...
I wonder why.
I don't think at least... I'd say there are at least 50 core drill holes in granite there. People don't go because it's been... It was heavily demolished by the post, all I could say is the post dynastic Egyptian people. So, you know, if a tour guide says, you know, we have half a dozen sites to go to, they're going to go, well, we want to go to Karnak and we want to go to the Giza Plateau and this. Yeah. And then if they see a picture of Abu Sir, it's like, that just looks like a pile of rocks. We don't want to go there. But they don't understand that. Some of these smaller sites have the most amazing examples of lost ancient high technology than other more famous locations.
So, that being said, I mean, with this lost civilization theory, which we're talking about today, and a lot of these cultures being based near the sea, and if there was a cataclysm, then a lot of these places would have gone under the floodwater, essentially. So, it may be lost to a history forever. Where would your... If you had to put money on it, where would you say the evidence of this lost civilization is going to be found?
I think in the Caribbean.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to say the Arctic or Antarctica, you know, buried under ice or something.
Well, that too.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah, the Antarctic, yeah.
Actually, that could be too, because it's quite possible that 12,000 plus years ago, our planet was perfectly vertical and not at 23.5 degrees. So that would put a large chunk of Antarctica in a temperate zone. So it could very well be that major structures are under the ice, and that could also be why there's so many scientists there.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that and other reasons, what we won't go into today, but yeah. So do you want to tell people where, you know, your stuff can be found?
Well, basically everything about me can be found at my main website, which is hiddeninkatours.com. There are, I think, 870-something YouTube videos, 22 books, a lot of articles and interviews and things like that. Most of it is all free information. The tour thing is only about 5% of the content. The other 95% is just free info.
I'll let you go because I know you're busy and that, so thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Cheers, mate.
Okay, cheers.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.